John Dennis here on Thursday, the 12th of February. Today, pressure on the Prime Minister after one of Gordon Brown's financial advisers quit over claims about his role in fueling the credit crunch.
James Crosbie was quite unique in that he ran Halifax and then HBOS at the height of probably our biggest ever housing boom.
Also today, a new power-sharing government in Zimbabwe, already gripped by a power struggle.
Mugabe, as president, had to swear in the new Prime Minister, Morgan Tsvangirai, a man who he'd said he would never even negotiate with.
And how Spotify, described as a cross between iTunes and Napster, could change the way we listen to music.
With Spotify, you have something that is getting closer to the, as you call it, the universal jukebox, the thing where you say, I'd like to listen to that song I listened to years ago, and it will be there.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, the news headlines and the papers with Sandy Waugh.
Two satellites have collided in space over Siberia while orbiting the Earth. A privately owned American communication satellite smashed into a defunct Russian craft. It's believed to be the first time that two satellites have crashed in orbit. NASA, the US space agency, says its scientists are now keeping a close watch on the debris. The crash has left a large cloud of smashed pieces in low orbit. Some will burn up as they re-enter the Earth's atmosphere. The remainder will join 18,000 man-made pieces of space junk now in orbit. Australian police are questioning two people suspected of deliberately starting some of the wildfires still burning in the southern state of Victoria. Authorities say more than 1,000 homes have been burnt down. 200 small towns north of Melbourne have been razed, leaving as many as 5,000 people homeless. In the USA, the two houses of Congress have ironed out differences in their different versions of the economic stimulus package. President Obama hopes, therefore, to be able to sign it into law within a few days. Meanwhile, he's told carmakers that he's still waiting for plans to transform their industry before he's prepared to grant them a promised bailout. Here in Britain, Gordon Brown will be questioned today over his role in the banking crisis. He'll appear before the Commons Liaison Committee the day after the Governor of the Bank of England warned the recession is even deeper than thought. Mr. Brown will also be grilled about the resignation of his business adviser, Sir James Crosbie, as Deputy Chairman of the Financial Services Authority. We'll have that full story shortly on the programme. As another sign of the recession, ITV has frozen the pay of its top executives. Those earning more than £60,000 a year will have no pay rise in 2009. Those on median wages will get a below-inflation increase. ITV suffering from a slump in earnings from advertising. The economy is still leading the front pages of the papers. Slump is the worst since the war, says The Telegraph, quoting that speech from the Bank of England. But it also notes there are still freebies for civil servants, reporting that almost 200 leading civil servants have enjoyed hospitality at sporting and arts events paid for by private companies. It makes your blood boil, shouts the Express. Brown's banker driven out, writes the Independent. Both are talking about Sir James Crosbie, the business boss, who was once in charge of the bank HBOS and was forced to resign yesterday. The Express shows his grand mansion in Yorkshire under the caption Luxury Life of Brown's Guilty Banker. The Guardian has the same story of the city regulator forced to resign, but its picture is of Eric Daniels of the Lloyds Banking Group. He told a Commons committee that though he earned £2.79 million, he thought that relatively modest. And the Times tells us that a statistics chief inflames row over foreign workers. The UK's official statistician says the number of foreign workers increased last year by nearly 200,000 to 2.4 million, while the number of British workers fell by over 200,000. More on the day's news and breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
Sir James Crosbie resigned yesterday as Deputy Chairman of the Financial Services Authority. He stepped down amid allegations that he fired a whistleblower called Paul Moore, who warned of dangerous lending practices at Halifax Bank of Scotland, or HBOS. Moore told the Treasury Select Committee he was dismissed after trying to warn HBOS's board that its over-eager sales team were putting the company's financial stability in jeopardy. I asked The Guardian's head of business, Dan Roberts, if Crosbie's resignation from the government's financial watchdog had been a surprise.
It was to me, actually, yes. I didn't think this story would have the legs that it has. I think in hindsight, though, it's quite clear that he was an embarrassment for Gordon Brown, and that Gordon Brown has got quite a lot of potential embarrassments being lined up for him at the moment, and there's just one that he could afford to do without.
Although Crosby says in his resignation statement that he was independent of the government, how bad is this for the Prime Minister?
Well, I think it's yet another sign of Brown surrounding himself by banking chiefs and business execs who have quite checkered histories. I mean, it's unfair to an extent in that anybody who's gone through the business boom that we've seen for the last 10 years is going to have a few skeletons in their closet. But James Crosby was quite unique in that he ran Halifax and then HBOS at the height of probably our biggest ever housing boom, and Halifax was the biggest mortgage lender. This was a man who more than anybody else perhaps embodied the housing bubble, and so it was a surprise that he'd risen so far within government, that he had been asked to do these reports, that he was the deputy chairman of the main financial regulator, because he did have a tainted past.
Although he does reject Paul Moore's allegations, it's slightly strange that he's resigned in a way, because he doesn't admit any of the allegations that are being fired at him.
Yes, and we understand that the FSA is still quite supportive of him, and that there's talk of sort of a report that was done on this, actually finding there not being much to answer for. I think the problem is that whatever the rights and wrongs of this guy's individual sacking, Paul Moore that is, he had a point. There were problems with HBOS that were flagged up, and the management at the time ignored them. James Crosby was the chief executive at the time. He ignored comments like Paul Moore's. The ins and outs of that particular whistleblower getting sacked, I don't think matter. What matters is that here's a man who was warned that it was coming, didn't do anything about it, and is now being asked to clean up the mess by the government. Doesn't look good.
And as you sort of hinted at earlier, I mean, the whole thing does raise questions about whether the people responsible for irresponsible lending on a massive scale that's led to the current financial crisis should be now regulating the banks.
Yes, it's a tricky one, because on the one hand, you want people who know what they're talking about, and the government has recruited some really top-notch city talent to advise it recently. Philip Hampton, Glenn Marino, Mervyn Davis. These are some of the most respected finance minds in Britain. On the other hand, you want some fresh thinking here. It didn't work. You know, the orthodox approach to the economy has got us into this mess. And there is a sense in which Brown and his advisors are a bit blinkered to alternative views, because they are very much of that old school.
Meanwhile, we've seen some more gloomy economic data. Unemployment close to 2 million now, and the governor of the Bank of England, Mervyn King, says Britain's in a deep recession that could get worse if efforts to save the banking system fail. What do you make of all that?
Yes, well, it's kind of come to something when the governor of the Bank of England stands up and says we're in deep mess and it's going to get deeper. You actually kind of go, well, is that it? Because actually, the mood music we're getting from people like Ed Balls, who said we're in the worst recession for 100 years, from Timothy Geithner, who runs the US Treasury, yesterday was saying similar, very, very alarming things about the US economy. When you hear Mervyn King say this, you kind of think, well, yeah, that's about right. The only bright spot in all this was the unemployment numbers were not quite as bad as people have feared. And there is a relative green shoot there, if nothing else.
Dan Roberts. Well, with unemployment edging towards the 2 million mark, as we've just heard, the use of foreign labour in Britain is arousing anger among many UK workers. We saw wildcat strikes at the Lindsay oil refinery at Immingham in Lincolnshire recently. And yesterday, labourers working on the new Staythorpe power station near Newark in Nottinghamshire downed tools in an unofficial strike, as Martin Wainwright reports.
I'm at Staythorpe near Newark in Nottinghamshire, where a new power station is being built, and it's the latest focus of the dispute over foreign workers. I say the latest, it did actually begin here. Before Christmas there were protests outside this plant, but it wasn't until last week and the really big protests at Lindsay on Humberside that the rest of the country sat up and took notice. So now they've all come here. There are people from Immingham here and lots of local guys as well. We've had a big picket at the power station, 600 or 700 people of incredibly tight security, both police and a very large force of private security officers. And they're now heading into Newark itself to have a march. And I believe you're going to have a march to the job centre.
March to the job centre, yeah. We're going from here to the job centre.
And what's the message you want to give people?
Well, the message is we've got British labour, and the skilled labour it is, and they can do these jobs over here. We've no objection to these people coming here to do these jobs, the Spanish and the Portuguese or any of them. We've no objection to that whatsoever. But we've got the skills to do these jobs. We've done them now. I've been in the game for 45 years, so I know what I'm on about. We can do these jobs. if we're short of labour, I've no objection to topping up with foreign labour. No objection whatsoever. But most of us are unemployed now.
How is it different now? I mean, when you apply, do they say, sorry, but we've brought our own labour for?
That's right. That's what's different now. They're bringing in their own labour.
The company, Alstom, have said that I think it's something like three quarters or two thirds of the jobs that's, over the whole course of Staythorpe will be British.
They're on the civil work. We do the construction and the plant.
So they'd be doing like the roads and the ordinary buildings, not the specialised stuff.
That's right. Yes, the groundwork.
Yeah. All we can say is all the lads, they've been in contracting all their life, and to see you people in this country possibly won't get a job contracting anymore, it's a big shame.
Especially when you're all so skilled. I mean, Harry, I was just talking to, as a rigger, what do you do, if I may ask?
I'm a rigger as well.
That's erecting the specialised machinery, like in this case the turbine and the pipework.
We do steel work as well. We've done all these jobs and we've been doing them for 40, 45 years. We don't want to see same as it was in the 80s where all other pits was closing and the younger generation had no good jobs to go to where the fathers used to work. We want to talk about this and we want to get a level playing field. We don't want to get into no trouble at all.
Martin Wainwright reporting, and the latest business news today and every day at guardian.co.uk/business. Also on The Guardian's website, Dog Shit Britain. John Henley investigates the highly emotive issue of dogs and their waste at guardian.co.uk/G2. And apparently we've got video of that as well. And also, the giant horse reported yesterday in Guardian Daily. Giant horse in Kent. Why a horse was chosen as the answer to the Angel of the North? Jilly Cooper writes. guardian.co.uk/arts. Morgan Tsvangirai has been sworn in as Prime Minister of Zimbabwe. The opposition leader took his oath in a ceremony presided over by his bitter rival, President Robert Mugabe. Chris McGreal reports from Harare.
It was a fairly subdued affair. Mugabe, as president, had to swear in the new Prime Minister, Morgan Tsvangirai, a man who he'd said he would never even negotiate with, let alone share power with. He did it reluctantly. He didn't look him in the eye. He didn't smile. He did shake Tsvangirai's hand. But I have to say that you could see there was no great enthusiasm on the president's part, nor on the part, it has to be said, of his old propaganda machines. The television, state radio, was still churning out the same misconceptions that they have over past years about the true nature of what's happening in Zimbabwe. And then came time for Tsvangirai to make a 5-minute address to the nation, which had been agreed. The television cameras simply cut away. The master of ceremonies said lunch was served, and the nation did not hear from Tsvangirai.
That doesn't suggest that they're going to be able to work together very well, does it?
No, it certainly suggests that things are going to be quite difficult for some time, as does the fact that the secret police last night, when looking for one of Tsvangirai's newly appointed ministers, a man called Roy Bennett, who's an old foe of Mugabe and ZANU-PF, he was slung into jail for about a year for punching a cabinet minister on the floor of Parliament. He's to be the new deputy agriculture minister, and he's now essentially in hiding until he's sworn in on Friday. There are other indications of the continuing friction, the refusal of the government to release about 30 political detainees who've been in for months and been very badly tortured. For all of that, Tsvangirai had a rally after his inauguration and tried to put a positive light on it, threw the whole thing forward, reminded people that February 11th was in fact the date 19 years ago that Nelson Mandela was released from prison, but that black South Africans weren't liberated on that date. It took another 4 years of very hard political negotiation before apartheid was brought to an end with democratic elections.
What do ordinary Zimbabweans think about the new coalition government?
I think they're cautious. I mean, I think what was notable at the rally was there was none of the electricity that swept through Zimbabwe last March when it appeared that Mugabe had lost the presidential election and might be forced out of office within days. We now know that he fought back with a very bloody and unpleasant campaign, violent campaign of intimidation and terror against the population. And so after enduring that, people are much more cautious. There is concern amongst a lot of Zimbabweans that somehow Mugabe will outmaneuver Tsvangirai and use him to get Western aid, but still to cling on to power. However, I think there's a realization at the same time that Mugabe has only gone into this coalition government because his position is increasingly weak. The economy has all but collapsed. The Zimbabwe dollar has ceased to exist as a currency. Everybody now deals in South African rand and US dollars. One of the things that got the biggest cheer at Tsvangirai's rally was a promise to start paying all civil servants, teachers, health workers, the army, in foreign currency. There was a huge cheer for that. And I think that people are, to use the old cliche, cautiously optimistic, but it's going to take time to build their confidence.
Chris McGreal. And now, another thought for the day. The Guardian's Comment is Free website is running a series under that banner this week and next, inspired by the BBC's Thought for the Day, but without the God bit. Today, the former agony aunt and vice president of the British Humanist Association, Claire Rayner, says the root of the current recession is greed.
Most people born before 1960 or so will remember that as children, their parents and teachers, and indeed any adults with whom they had dealings, regarded being greedy as one of the worst things a person could be. I was told always to leave a little of my dinner at the side of my plate for Mr. Manners, and it had to be the food I liked best. Only greedy people left spinach or the fat on bacon instead of lovely hot buttery toast or mashed potatoes. Greed, I was told, was as bad as being a liar or a thief or not being polite or not putting other people's needs first. Why is it that in this first decade of the 21st century, we're in such a dreadful state? We're sliding into an appalling greed-created depression, possibly worse than the 1929 collapse, when millions lost their jobs and the country nearly went bankrupt. It took a world war to get people to remember the childhood virtues of hard work, loyalty and duty, and above all, not being greedy. This new extra-large 21st century style worst ever depression has ever been is happening for the same reason it happened in 1929. People forgot what they had been taught about greed. One modern head of state, the Prime Minister of the UK, however, forgot before everyone else. She was possibly the greediest of all, with the US President Ronald Reagan doing his best to match her. In the late 70s and early 80s, she set about dismantling the systems used by the City of London money markets. Stockbrokers and bankers and financiers who were, like Mrs. T, amnesiac about the rules regarding greed and caring about other people in general, began to get enormous salaries. They didn't earn them, mind you, but they got them. The old system had existed to protect our money from such grabbers who might pull fancy tricks to increase their private incomes. But she saw no sense in that. She opened the market, got rid of the regulations, and the result was inevitable. Greed ruled everything, which is why, two or three decades later, we face the misery of a full-blown depression. It's high time that Mr. Manners and all the disapproval of greed that his existence implied was revived. And that we also got rid of lotteries and TV bingo and poker games promising big wins. The greed they exemplified damages us all.
Claire Rayner, and you can listen to the rest of the series, which is supported by the Humanist Society of Scotland, at guardian.co.uk/commentisfree. I'm John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily, actor Angela Bassett talks to The Guardian about her new film, Notorious.
I didn't have any misgivings, so perhaps I should have, I don't know, but it seems like it's in the past and we see what the... We see what the carnage of it is. We see what the, you know, the sad, you know, we see what we're left without, you know, two geniuses.
But first, Spotify is a new online streaming service that allows you to listen to vast libraries of music for free and without breaking the law. It could change the whole landscape of digital music, as The Guardian's technology editor Charles Arthur explains.
Spotify is a new music service which uses the internet rather like a radio. It streams music directly over the internet to your computer. You download a little application which runs on your machine and you can sift through thousands and thousands of songs, create your own playlists. You can even create what are called collaborative playlists, which you can share with other people. They can add to, take away from. It's quite an innovative way of dealing with music.
Is there anything like this already? Because, I mean, I've seen Last FM, for instance.
Yeah, Last FM, which is a British company, does do something quite similar. It will let you pick a genre or an artist or a particular song, and it will let you find music that's sort of similar to it. But it doesn't do exactly this. It doesn't let you say, I want to find Kylie Minogue's Can't Get You Out of My Head and listen to that. It'll sort of let you do that on Last FM once, and then you're pretty much done with it. You have to then move on to other tracks and other things. With Spotify, you can listen to the same song as many times as you really feel like.
You've likened it, Charles, to early Napster. Is the idea of the universal jukebox really the holy grail as far as delivery of music on the internet is concerned?
It really is. The thing that people have wanted so long, which the original Napster, the illegal one, where people were downloading songs between their computers, what so-called peer-to-peer file sharing. The thing that people really wanted was to be able to just find any song they wanted any time and just have it and listen to it. The trouble is that the music labels have lots of restrictive copyright in terms of regions, in terms of availability for songs, which has kept those off the internet. So that's meant that piracy has been a big, big problem for them. But with Spotify, you have something that is getting closer to the, as you call it, the universal jukebox, the thing where you say, I'd like to listen to that song I listened to years ago, and it will be there.
Okay, Charles, what are the drawbacks of Spotify?
Well, it's not so much drawbacks as really just gaps in the catalogue at the moment. For example, I was looking around and, for example, one thing that I always find as an interesting test is to search for King Crimson, because Robert Fripp has a great dislike of record companies, and you find that there's a very, very limited King Crimson category there. A lot of it is actually tribute bands and sort of tribute tracks. So there are holes in the universal jukebox, if you like. There's gaps where the records just don't come through. But it has to be said that a lot of it works very smoothly.
You can't get Spotify as yet on mobile or handheld devices like iPods.
No, you can't. It's something that they're still working on. I think that the record labels are more interested in just letting them do it on fixed computers for now. It doesn't take up very much bandwidth. As I said, it streams the data down to your computer across the internet, and it needs a pretty small bandwidth. I think it's around about 64 kilobits per second. But the problem is that, of course, if you have it on a mobile device, you're going to eat up a lot of data with that. But I think they are working on versions for mobile phones and for iPhones and things, and I would expect to see that possibly by the end of the year.
Charles Arthur. Angela Bassett plays Violetta Wallace, the mother of the rapper Biggie Smalls, in the new biopic Notorious. Wallace was a co-producer of the film, so The Guardian's Hannah Poole asked Bassett if that meant she was very hands-on.
I think so, but in a laid-back way, I would say. Probably initially, when you're getting the script together, more involved there, and in choosing me, asking for me to portray her. And on the set, I could certainly have a lot of dialogue with her, on the set before filming about her choices and about the script. She was, vocal about, making sure that certain things were said that she actually said. But she was also laid back in that she knows that it's only a, almost 2-hour movie about a whole life. And how impossible that is, impossible situation. So it's an overview, and some things are changed for, dramatic license, dramatic reason.
Did you have any misgivings about the film?
No, not at all. I think on the whole East Coast, West Coast, that rivalry and stuff, I didn't have any misgivings. Perhaps I should have, I don't know. But it seems like it's in the past, and we see what the carnage of it is. We see what the, the sad, we see what we're left without, two geniuses.
Much was made of the fact that you turned down the lead female role in Monsters Ball.
Was there? Like I say, you choose what you like.
I read an interview with Lawrence Fishburne, I think, and he said that you were very particular about your roles. That seems to be
Hey, listen, I don't have anyone who's gone before me say, Angela, hey, let me guide you in this career. You know, it's a career about images. It's a career on celluloid. They last forever. You know, it's a career. I'm a black woman from America. You know, the history of America. My people were slaves in America. I'm not going to allow you to, even though we're free on paper and in laws, enslave me on film for celluloid for all to see to go across the water to countries where people will never meet people who look like me, but that's their idea, and that must be what they are. So, you know, it becomes a bigger thing than me just being a movie star or me just being on TV. It's all about educating minds. There are people across on the other side of the world, on the moon, other galaxies, who never meet me, but those who, you know, make the films, you know, and said, this is how we want to, this is how you're shown.
Angela Bassett talking to Hannah Poole. Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.